You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Marina Ottaway with the Middle East program here at the Endowment. I just want to welcome you before introduce Colonel Joe Rayburn and turn over to him the moderating of this meeting. We have asked him to do double duty. He'll both moderate the meeting and also add his remarks. So let me, without further ado, let me just introduce him briefly, and then we'll go on from there. Colonel Joe Rayburn is a senior military fellow at the National Defense University's Institute for National Strategic Studies. He's a U.S. Army intelligence officer with many, many years of experience. He has served in many different positions, but most relevant to this discussion, he served in Iraq under General Petraeus. Over to you.
Right. So it's an honor and a treat to be here today and to introduce two such distinguished co-panelists here. Let me start with Ambassador Ad Melker, the former Special Representative of the Secretary General for Iraq. Ambassador Melker served as UN Special Representative of the Secretary General for Iraq from July 2009 until just last September. He was formerly Associate Administrator of the UN Development Program, and prior to that, served as an Executive Director on the board at the World Bank, where he represented 12 countries. Ambassador Melkert also previously had a prominent political career in the Dutch Labor Party, which culminated in his 2001 election as party leader. And he's also a candidate for Director General of the International Labor Organization in the upcoming May 2012 elections, for which we wish him the best of luck. And I would say that you are our candidate for that post. Marina Ottaway, and it's a bit humbling to introduce Marina at her own institution. She is a senior associate here at the Carnegie Endowment, and she works on issues of political transformation in the Middle East and Gulf security. She is a longtime analyst of the formation and transformation of political systems, and she's also written extensively on political reconstruction in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Balkans, and African countries. Her extensive research experience is reflected in her publications, which include 9 authored books and 6 edited ones. And she's also an author of Carnegie's Guide to Egypt's Transition, which is a website that provides background and analysis on issues that will shape Egypt's political future. So we couldn't have two better qualified panelists to judge the political turmoil that has unfolded in Iraq over the past few months, and to give us their thoughts on what it means for Iraq, what it means for the rest of us, and where it's likely to lead in the future. So with that preamble out of the way, I'll turn it over to Ambassador Melkert.
Well, thank you very much, Colonel, and it's really a very good opportunity, and I'd like to thank Carnegie also for that possibility to speak about Iraq, if only to ensure that attention will remain focused at the aftermath of many events that kept many of us busy for a long period of time, but then with other topics coming up. I've experienced myself, actually, at the time that I was the UN Special Representative, a kind of decline in interest that I think is not serving anybody's interest, because Iraq is really a very crucial country in a very crucial region in a very crucial at a very crucial point of time. The title for this event, State of Iraq, Solution to the Growing Strife, immediately raises a few points from my perspective. Strife, yes, certainly there is. Everybody who reads and follows can notice who the actors are and what is at stake. Is the strife growing? I don't know for sure, and I'll come back on that, because what we may be seeing is a pattern that is more inherent in the situation in Iraq, given a number of factors, given the history, given the interests at play. Can we talk about, yes, but can we think about solutions? Well, solution is a big word for what we are seeing unfold, so I'm not going to venture that in any case. For me, the main point, actually, also on the basis of my experience and in trying to exchange that today with you, is to be quite humble, actually, about what we think we see in Iraq and what we try to understand. In a way, I believe we're all students of what's going on in Iraq. First of all, students that have to learn to understand how Iraq really looks after three decades of oppression and a number of years of occupation. So in other words, the normal phase of Iraq, what is it? Probably we have to go back a long time in history in order to see a similar situation where the different actors and representatives of interest could quite openly compete for power. It hasn't happened for a long time. So what we see today is certainly quite new to most of us. We're all students because also we are learning to grasp the paradigm changes in the region. We are looking at every day almost at the position of Iran in the region and to an extent versus other key actors in the region, the international tensions, but also the domestic prospects of what's going on in Iran are to a large extent also defining what the impact of that would be on Iraq. And the domestic prospects in Iran should not be underestimated in their potential impact with elections for parliament coming up next month and elections for the presidency next year. And the probability that Iran is not isolated, maybe to the contrary, of many events that we've witnessed in the region more generally. Myself, I never like to speak about Arab Spring. I think it's really a more regional spring or awakening or rise that we see. So it will potentially change the region and, as a consequence, have impact on Iraq. There's the role of Turkey in the region. Turkey that has become a very, very important player, certainly also in Iraq, but also has to grapple with the contradictions or the tensions in trying to play a broker's role, whether it's to Iran, whether it's with Syria and the opposition in Syria, whether it's with different groups in Iraq. All that is potentially changing the paradigm in the region, but how exactly is very difficult to predict. Iraq is very much part of the axis Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and this is courtesy Paul Salem, the head of Carnegie in Lebanon, in Beirut, and I think he is right in trying to position Iraq and what we try to see in Iraq in the context of the interaction between particularly those four countries. What's also going on in the region are the domestic accommodation policies in the Gulf states and in Saudi Arabia, trying to somehow find a response to the events, in particularly in North Africa, with a very clear more than ripple effect in the Gulf region, and how that will play out and what the impact of that will be on Iraq again is very hard to predict. And then there's, of course, North Africa's next stage. I can't summarize it shorter, but it's just a shorthand for a very big issue that we're all looking at, we're all witnessing, we're trying maybe to contribute to or to influence, but certainly no one is in the position to define what will be that next stage and what will be the implications for the region. So that's why I think the second part of learning about Iraq is really to grasp the paradigm changes that are going on in the region. But it's not just one moment in time. It's a process that every day adds a small part to a much bigger picture. And the third need for us to learn about Iraq post-2003 is to decode the reality in the country. And in a way, we have to try to liberate ourselves from the trap of perception that is so much defined, actually, by the invasion in 2003, its aftermath, the way it's being reported. And we're still suffering from that perception problem. Let me just quote the New York Times on the 29th of January, where it stated, "Today, Iraq is more stable than it was at the height of the violence, but with American troops gone, sectarian and bloodshed are on the rise." End of quote. It's not true, and I will come back later to that. But there's still something in our mind that has been defined by 2003 and the years after, and that hinders us in a way to really see what's going on in Iraq. So when we look at the political infighting or competition or whatever, is it really political stasis that we see? What is the nature of the external power play that's going on? It's obvious that there is a lot of actors outside Iraq that are pushing and pulling. What is the real nature of that? So how is security or insecurity evolving? What's going on with the economy? We all have to try to look harder at the facts, and admittedly, it's not always easy to really get the facts on the table in a systematic way. But this is all part of trying to learn how Iraq looks today. Let me say a few things about this decoding of the reality in Iraq, particularly the question of what's going on politically, whether it is a stalemate that we see or whether it's something different. Trying to look at the bigger picture, I would like to submit that Iraq is just at the start of working on the basis of of regained constitution-based sovereignty. It's maybe not longer than 2 or 3 years that the Iraqis are really themselves in the position to define their own policies, their own position in the region, and their own interaction with external actors. So in that sense, the post-Saddam period, in terms of Iraq's sovereignty, has only begun very recently. And what we see, this daily visibility of internal power play that involves virtually all currents of ethnic, political, sectarian, and tribal significance, in fact, constitutes a unique moment in Iraq's post-1958 history. That open play and that participation of virtually all currents or representatives of all currents of significance has not been seen before. So what I think we see is the replacement of a relatively uniform dictatorial rule by the imprint of a fragmented reality, a very fragmented reality, but it is a reality. So in other words, talking about political stasis might in fact be just defining, just describing what one sees in terms of how the mosaic, the reality of a society looks like, with different actors trying to have their own position defined and impact gained. So the key of how this will unfold is whether the rules of the game that have been put in place by the Constitution will hold. Will the Constitution hold? Because by and large, the key actors are still playing on the basis of the rules of the game. Not every dot and comma and paragraph of the Constitution, but it is something that holds the actors together, and in my view, is therefore a really very important basis for what's going on now and trying to see whether this is strong enough to keep actors committed in the future. And there may be two or three reasons to be still cautiously optimistic about whether those rules of the game will hold. I said I was cautiously optimistic in my last report to the Security Council last July. I must admit that I am sometimes wondering whether I'm still as optimistic as I was at that time. Certainly I'm more cautious now. And yet there are some factors that I think could help us not to be too gloomy about what's going on. First of all, I believe that an important factor remains the, one could say, survival, political survival, interest and instinct of the generation that came to power post-2003. Many of them having been abroad, coming back, some part of the resistance against Saddam, others in one way or the other, some distance or perhaps sometimes less distance related to the Saddam regime, but all have an interest to keep basically the order that came into place after 2003, because they know that the alternative would probably not be kind to any of them. So sticking to the rules of the game is also the interest of those that share power at this moment. I believe that is also the case for Prime Minister Maliki, who of course stands, so to speak, accused by many of building an increasingly dominant position. And certainly he is in a dominant position, but one could still argue that, first of all, he's not alone in that position. He's part of a broader coalition that actually provides him with the possibility to govern in the way that he does. His position may also, in absence, a kind of default position in absence of agreement on alternatives between potential competitors. And certainly, his position is also defined by suspicion of considerable competitive powers that exist both within the country and outside the country. So in other words, in my view, also the Prime Minister and his position and his policies that we see today are still linked to the rules of the game that remain in place. Secondly, what we see also is a gradual normalization of administrative and economic patterns of interaction that create institutional and or business interests and stakeholders that would not benefit from upheaval of any kind. There are more and more investors, domestically and also foreign investors, that have really a stake in the future of Iraq. There is a small group, but an important group of competent managers in the administration that, with some success at some points with less success in other areas, are slowly contributing to normalization of administration, of delivery by the government. It's going slow. There are certainly a lot of political risks involved. But progress is there, and the longer this holds, the more normalization one would see on the ground. And I would certainly not discount here also the long-standing tradition of administrative competence that is rooted in the history of Mesopotamia. And it's always good to tell each other as Europeans and Americans that that history is really a lot longer than the way that we have governed ourselves in our parts of the world. And then there is a third reason why one could argue that things are not all that bad. And that is linked to the events in the region that, in fact, have reduced, as a kind of implication, the space for potential spoilers of the post-2003 order. What's happening today in Syria with Assad is certainly not anything of an encouragement to those that in Iraq have not completely internalized the democratic spirit of the constitution, but nevertheless also know that space for alternatives has been reduced compared to where the region was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And I believe in the bigger picture, those things matter. So what we basically see is the pluralism of ethnic, sectarian, tribal, ideological, and interest-driven forces that are competing for power and still adhering, by and large, to the rules of the game. Now, does that mean that everything is rosy? Certainly not. There are, of course, many risks and threats. I don't think I have the time to elaborate on each of them. But maybe for the discussion, it would be worth to touch upon some issues in particular. Let me mention a few. What we have seen in the past few months with the retreat from the withdrawal by Iraqiya from the government and even for a short period of time from parliament was, of course, risky in terms of maintaining the basis of the so-called Erbil consensus, the basis for the government of national unity, as we know it right now. The reports of the recent 10 days suggest that everybody is taking his or her, mostly his, place again, which means that President Talabani has also or is also managing to maintain the wide agreement between the major parties, which in itself I think is a step forward, because if this Erbil consensus would have unraveled, certainly the risk of internal strife would have tremendously increased. Also anticipating, that's my second point, the rounds of elections that will arrive quite soon. In September, there will be elections for the governorates in the Kurdistan region. Early next year, there should be elections for the provincial councils, and early the year after, 2014, is the next round for the Council of Representatives for the parliament. And it goes without saying that these are moments that will again test actually the solidity of the rules of the game and whether everybody will stick to it, as happened in 2010 with the national elections. But I can testify that it did not just go by itself, and that was in a period where the international community, US and UN, were still much stronger present. There will be ongoing intra-Shia tensions. I won't elaborate on that. Intra-Sunni competition in terms of who is the representative with really the most weight at that side of the spectrum. There are ongoing challenges, basically, to the rather centralized order in with regard to the administration of Iraq, just with the Kurdistan region with its own space as a very autonomous region within the federal state of Iraq, but other provinces or governorates also knocking on the door for having more autonomy. I believe that it is not very likely that that will lead to changes anytime soon in the current structure of the federal state, but obviously it is a potential source of tension. The disputed areas in the north between the Kurds and Arabs are still on the agenda, including the future of Kirkuk. Yet I find it fascinating that tensions have not increased and maybe have to an extent somewhat decreased in terms of knowing how to live with the ambiguity that still exists, and maybe that can exist for a very long period of time. Syria, in terms of risks and threats, the outcome of Syria will certainly impact Iraq. How exactly is difficult predict. But it's clear that the government of Maliki has actually maintained for a relatively long time expressions of support for Syria, and there is also the border between Syria and Iraq that is that could play a role in keeping the pressure on Syria. And then the big elephant in the room, I would say, is everything that would that we could imagine, but I'm certainly not going to elaborate on that, with regards to Iran, the impact on the oil markets, Iraq, of course, as the neighbor to Iran, also being able to provide alternatives to sanctions or to help circumvent sanctions. It's all part of the bigger equation that requires a lot of attention. And the impact of tension with Iran on Iraq would be huge, in my view. So let me stop here and just tell myself in the first place, but I hope it will also convince some of you, that there are still grounds for being cautiously optimistic for some of the reasons that I mentioned. Iraq is part of a development in the region that has opened up many more avenues for Islamist rule in very different ways and means when you look at the different countries. Tunisia is not Egypt. Egypt is not Iraq. But there are also some similarities that change also, I think, the equation. Looking at it from the US or from the European perspective as to with whom we are dealing, actually, in that part of the world. And there is, of course, the change in the position of the US that finds itself now between being an enforcement power and wanting to be an empowerment force in the region. So the stepping back militarily after trying to find a way to remain in Iraq, but underestimating, frankly, the deep drive in Iraq to be sovereign, and that's not only at the Shia side, that is really very broadly shared, to be sovereign, but at the same time not closing themselves for cooperation with the UN, cooperation with the Europeans, cooperation with Asian countries that play in a very important role, particularly where it comes to the oil production. So that has all changed Iraq, with the bottom line, we want to be sovereign and then define our relations with our neighbors and with the wider world. So that is what I think I see at this moment in Iraq, but also after the years that I had the privilege to be there because it was really a privilege. I still feel a student, and I think many of us are. Thank you.
Thank you. Marina.
It's somewhat humbling to come after a speaker who has such a direct experience in Iraq, which I certainly don't have. I have worked on Iraq for many years, but from a distance certainly have not had that hands-on experience. But listening to Ad Melkert speak, I understood better an email he sent me as we were preparing this conference. I sent him a copy of the paper I was working on, and essentially he said, if I can paraphrase your email, I don't really disagree with you, but you are somewhat too pessimistic. And I would argue that the difference is that while he remains cautiously optimistic, I have become cautiously pessimistic. In other words, I am not ready to say it's a hopeless situation, but I certainly see it as a situation that is very, very difficult. And I think it's going that the positive outcome that we all hope for, essentially, is increasing the difficulty. I see the obstacles very, very serious. I will try to put my remarks, which I'll keep very short, because we have a third speaker and we want to leave time for discussion. I want to try to put them in the, also in the context of the broader transformations that are taking place in the region, because I would argue that at the center of the problems that Iraq is experiencing at this point is this blossoming of pluralism that we see not only in Iraq, but we see in all countries that emerge from a period of authoritarianism, but the pluralism which is not regulated by rules that everybody is adhering to. Yes, there are rules. There are rules in the making. There is a constitution. It's a constitution that is still being interpreted as, you know, people are interpreting the constitution as it goes along. You can say, well, the U.S. constitution is still being reinterpreted after, you know, after 200 years. And the fact is that there are many more reinterpretation of that constitution that is going on. And it is really this almost unfettered pluralism, which is the main problem that I see in Iraq right now, that coupled with the regional situation, and here I truly differ with the previous speaker, that I think is going to make the situation much more difficult, because I think the regional situation is pushing Iraq into the direction of heightened sectarian conflict, because unfortunately the politics of the region, as I see it at this point, is really dominated by sectarian considerations. So let me talk briefly about the pluralism and what I would consider to be, you know, you cannot have democracy without pluralism, but there is healthy pluralism and there is unhealthy pluralism. And the most unhealthy type of pluralism, I think, is pluralism where people are sort of caught in fixed positions. In other words, where it's not possible to move from one side to another. And here, ethnic and religious identities are the most destructive of all. You are not going to be Sunni one day and Shia another day. You are not going to be Kurd one day and Arab another day. You can be a Democrat one day and a Republican on the other. And essentially, the political identities are in flux. And in fact, we always forget that what really makes democracy possible is those people who change their mind. Because if people were always making the same choices, then there would not be an alternating of parties in power, and that would be a real serious problem from the point of view of the survival of democracy. What we have in Iraq right now is forms of pluralism that, yes, where there is room for change, and there are forms of pluralism where there is not. And I would argue that the most serious, the most detrimental, the most dangerous form of pluralism that we have now, and this comes as no surprise, of course, is that pluralism which is based on identity, which is based on religious and the ethnic identities. We always hear a lot about the fact that, well, it was not always that way. You hear a lot about the fact that there were a lot of mixed marriages before. Before, you hear that tribes have both Sunni and Shia members and so on. I think we have entered the situation now, and not just in the last few months, but for a long time, in which people have to choose between one identity or another. I think polarized situations like the situation like the one in Iraq lead to polarization because people have to make a choice one way or another where they want to belong. You cannot be, and this is unfortunately not just true of. It's not just true of Iraq. We have seen the same. We saw the same situation in Bosnia and the part in many parts of the previous Yugoslavia. You are seeing the same situation in Bahrain. In Bahrain right now, where people that had always tried to play down their sectarian identity, their ethnic identities, are being forced to make choices. There are other forms of pluralism that are much less dangerous. In fact, I would argue are positive. There is a great deal of pluralism of political parties. Political pluralism is a good thing. It may be somewhat excessive in Iraq, as it is in all countries that are undergoing a transition. There were too many political parties were formed. There were at one point over 300 political parties. Well, the political spectrum has to shake down at some point. There is no room in any political system for that many political parties. But that's a minor problem, and it happens because parties disappear because they don't get anywhere. That's a very positive form of pluralism. Unfortunately, this positive form of pluralism, the pluralism of political parties, also links in the case of Iraq to the sectarian and ethnic pluralism, because some of the dominant parties, not all, but some of the most political parties are essentially still sectarian parties. And I would argue that despite the fact that they all protest that they are not sectarian parties. In fact, in the political campaign before the 2010 elections, all parties were making a point of declaring themselves non-sectarian. All parties made a point of making sure that they had members and leaders from all different groups and so on. But in reality, there were they had a different. They were perceived by the public as having certain identities. Perhaps the most obvious case is that of Iraqia, which is led by, by a Shia. The Secretary General, or whatever his title is, I'm not quite sure, but has been widely perceived by the voters as being a Sunni party. And there is a paradox here, but that is the reality of that situation. There are a lot of Sunnis in Maliki's state of law alliance, but again, it was not seen as predominant in those terms. So there is this healthy pluralism of the political parties is linked to the less healthy pluralism of these fixed sectarian identities that tend to become even more fixed as when strife starts. A very interesting type of pluralism which is developing, to which the previous speaker alluded, that I'd like to put a little more emphasis on, is what is developing now in the relationship between the central government, the federal government, if you want, and the regions. And that is both very good, because Iraq is a large country, and I think a large country like Iraq really should not be governed from the center. It should not be governed by line ministries in Baghdad that make decisions for the region. So I think the dynamic, the struggle for power, if you want, the competition that exists at this point between the central government and the provincial councils is essentially healthy. The problem is that because of the weakness of the rules of the game, it's also contested terrain, because it is not clear at this point how the, where exactly what is the division of power between the central government and the provinces. And we have a position in which the provinces are pushing for more autonomy, are pushing for greater powers and so on. We could say, yes, these are growing pains. It's not strange that there is no clarity about the rules of the game, and I totally agree. The question is whether there is whether Iraq is going to have the time to grow, essentially, for the rules to develop, for adherence to the rules to develop, before it really breaks down into conflict between the central government and the provincial governments. I don't know. I find it. I am not too sure. What we have seen recently is attempt by many provinces to try to push to become regions. That is to acquire a degree of autonomy. Like the autonomy which is enjoyed by Kurdistan, because that is the implication of the transformation from a province into a region, that you acquire, that the regional government has much more power than a provincial government. There is a lot of push and pull on that issue. It's very difficult to know exactly where it is going to be. Whether some of the provinces will pull back, probably, but I'm not sure that this is going to be the case with all. And I would argue that if more provinces get their autonomy, in other words, if the idea of creating a region with a larger degree of autonomy extends beyond Kurdistan, then we'll see a strong push for it in other directions. Finally, if I look at I'll just stop there on the issue of pluralism. But I want to bring in the other side, because so far what I have talked is built-in conditions. That is, pluralism existed in Iraq well before the Americans came. I never quite understood the accusation against the United States that somehow the United States had introduced confessional politics into Iraq. All you have to look is at the composition of the Iraq National Congress before to know that it does not make any sense to sort of to attribute the strong impact of sectarianism on the country on what the United States did or failed to do. It was there to begin with. But in addition to looking at the conditions, I think it is very important also to look at agency, because it's not just a question of who is, of what the conditions are, what happens. It's also a question of what the most important actors are doing. And I would argue that if you look at the main actors in the situation now, Iraq carries a very important burden. And one of the burdens that Iraq has, in addition to the specific tendencies of various players, you know, I don't think you can accuse Nouri al-Maliki to be particularly democratic. You cannot accuse Alawi to be particularly democratic. I mean, there are not many people with strong democratic tendencies in the top leadership. But I think there is another issue that needs to be taken into consideration. That is, Iraq is burdened with what I would call historic leaders, with a number of people who have played a role for a long period of time. They played a role when Saddam Hussein was still there. And these are leaders who feel that they have essentially a right to be in the leadership structure. And I think you see that in many countries. Again, I'd like to put that in somewhat of comparative perspective. And perhaps the most tragic case that I know of a country that has been burdened with its historic leaders is Algeria, which is still trying to work its way through this long succession of historic leaders who were there in the fight for independence. And the only reason why finally it's working its way through the long list is that one by one they are dying, because with Algeria having become independent in 1962, obviously the age is taking its tolls and many of these personalities are beginning to disappear. But there are a lot of people in Iraq still now who think that they have have a right to be in a leadership position. Alawi feels that he has a right to be in a leadership position. Chalabi feels that he has a right to be in a leadership position. And that is something which is very, in other words, these are people who are more than just, at least in their own eyes, more than just leaders of political parties. But they have sort of a built-in right to be in a position, and that I think is a real problem for many countries. Finally, and this is the last comment that I want to make in terms of agency, you also have to look at the neighboring countries. And here I truly disagree with the previous speaker. I think the situation in the region is going to make is going to aggravate the internal problem that Iraq is facing, because, like it or not, the regional the politics of the region is moving in the direction of sectarian conflict. The talk about the Iran-Iraq Syria. One should say Hezbollah more than Lebanon, arc, if you want. The Shia crescent, of which King Abdullah of Jordan spoke at one point, which is coming back with a vengeance. And I would argue that the policies of most countries, of neighboring countries towards Iraq, are colored, are determined essentially by this sectarian perspective. The Gulf countries have resisted embracing the new government essentially embracing Iraq, because they are perceiving Iraq as being a pawn of Iran. Whether or not it is true, they are certainly contributing to pushing Iraq in the arms of Iran. But there is no doubt that the policies of the Gulf countries towards Iraq, are driven by this perception of what is the relationship between Iran and Iraq. The perception of increasingly, even countries that have tried to avoid the sectarian perspective are being pushed in that direction. And here the best example is Turkey. Turkey really tried to not to play the sectarian card or the ethnic card for a long time. There was an incredible turnaround, a very remarkable turnaround by Turkey in terms of reconciling itself to the autonomy of Kurdistan, to establishing good relationship with Kurdistan and with the central government in Iraq. And yet Turkey is essentially being pushed in the direction of playing a Sunni card at this point. I think it's still resisting it to some extent, but I don't think this is continuing much longer. And in that sense, I would argue that what is happening in Syria, in fact, is contributing to the sectarian perspective, essentially, with which neighbors are that colors the way in which neighbors are dealing with Iraq. Let me stop there and turn it over to our next speaker, who is both the moderator and the speaker. But so I'll pass it over to you.
Thank you, Marina. If Ambassador Melkert is cautiously optimistic and Marina is cautiously pessimistic, I would say I'm both, depending on the frame of time that we're talking about. In the long term, I'm with Ambassador Melkert. I think that Iraq has great potential, and I'm cautiously optimistic about the way Iraq will turn out. I think 10 to 12 years from now, we will be looking at a much different Iraq, one that is a leader in the region in terms of economics and culture and so on, that will probably have found some stable politics by then. And I think we'll be in a much friendlier region. Beyond the enormous natural resources that Iraq has to draw upon, which hold incredible economic potential, the Iraqi economy could grow to 3-4 times its current size, perhaps, in the regional context. And if not a very strong human capital, Iraqis have a memory of human capital, and I think they have a strong desire to return to that age of human capital that they once had. But in the near term, I think it will be a very painful 5 to 7 years or so that Iraqis will have to go through and that the region will have to pass through in order to get to that more positive potential outcome. Because alongside the healthy pluralistic model that Ambassador Melkert describes and the unhealthy pluralistic model that Marina describes, I think there's another game going on in Iraq, and that is the consolidation of control of the state, almost detached from this pluralistic politics. In Iraq today, I think it's becoming more and more appropriate to speak not of the Iraqi government or even of a Shia-dominated government or even a Dawa-dominated government, but rather of a Maliki regime. This is the newly dominant force in Iraqi politics. These are the Malikists. They're an analog to the Saddamists in many ways, or the Saddamiyun, as Iraqis knew them. And so I'd like to coin the term today, the Malikiyun. I think this is something that Iraqis will recognize. And these are the officials and the operators who have enabled Prime Minister Maliki to consolidate control of state power and gradually marginalize the other political blocs as they've done it, while neutralizing one by one the checks and balances that the Iraqi constitution was meant to contain on just such a consolidation of power. So I'd like to talk a little bit to dig down a little bit and talk some about where we can find the Malikiyun, who they are, how they behave, and what policies they'll follow, and what that will mean for Iraq and the rest of us, my best guess. So first, in acquiring power in Iraq, the Malikiyun have focused on the security and intelligence apparatus, the coercive arms of the state, and this is where you can most easily find them. You can find them at the top of the Ministry of Defense, at the top of the Ministry of Interior, at the top of the intelligence services. You will find them in control of the Iraqi special operations forces and in the police commandos, and any forces that can that have coalesced into a new sort of coup-proofing set of forces, almost a new special Republican Guard. Now, next, who are they individually? Well, individually, they are not really the Dawa Party. This is not really the Dawa Party. They are. At the center, they're Maliki's family, including his son and son-in-law, most significantly. They're his personal advisors, both official and unofficial, so those that are in the prime minister's office and those that are in Maliki's house, you know, in the Diwan late at night making decisions. They're also, if they're from the Dawa Party, they tend to be Dawa Party orphans. In other words, they're Dawa members who have no independent base of their own in the party, and or in the larger movement that spawned it. So they're Dawa members that you really didn't hear about before 2003, with just a few exceptions. There are also some of them useful former Baathists, some of whom actually worked directly for Saddam or other very senior leaders in the old regime, and this is especially true in the intelligence services. And there are also political generals who are, most of them, originally high-ranking officers in Saddam's army. Next, they're not really sectarian. For one thing, they're not all Shia. Some of them are Sunnis, some of them are Kurds. Occasionally you see one pop up that's a Christian. And writ large, the Malikiyun will use the Shia sectarian card when it serves their political purposes. But they're just as ready to suppress Shia opposition as any other opposition. It's more about the challenge to their political power. Next, they are not Iranian puppets. They are, however, aligned with the Iranian regime's foreign policy, and this makes their regime behave as a sectarian power in the region along the lines that Marina was talking about, along that sectarian fault line that runs through the region today from the Gulf to the Mediterranean. And in fact, they behave more as a sectarian power in the region than they do inside Iraq. But in this context, they still see a need to balance Iran, to balance the Iranian regime against the United States and vice versa to some extent because they really don't trust the Iranians. So what do they believe? What is their ideology? Well, they don't really have one. They don't believe much. They don't espouse core religious principles. These are not really devout religious guys except in a pro forma sense that's required of a nominally Shia Islamist party. And they don't really live the Dawa core values that marked the old Dawa party, the idea that laymen should be models of the principles of an Islamic of an Islamic life. They are driven instead, overwhelmingly, by the acquisition and holding of power. They don't trust anyone outside the circle of the Malikiyun, and occasionally they don't trust some of them that are in the circle of the Malikiyun. So you find significant members of the Malikiyun who are pushed out from time to time. And lastly, and above all, they're deeply committed to keeping Prime Minister Maliki in power, because the fact is, and he has selected members of the Malikiyun for this characteristic, if he were to fall, they have nowhere to go. They would lose everything. Their power that they hold inside Iraq derives from his completely. In fact, if they begin to develop an independent base of power, that's who he usually pushes out. Let me describe what the Malikiyun are doing now. Right now, they are focused on eliminating the two major threats to Maliki's rule inside Iraq, Ayad Alawi and Muqtada Sadr, whom they view as the only real alternatives to Maliki in Iraq. They will not reconcile with Alawi and Iraqiyya. I will make the prediction here today. They are bent on breaking Iraqiyya as a political bloc and refashioning some of it into a rump Iraqiyya that they can dominate and deal with while they force Alawi and other senior Iraqiyya members out of public life. And then they will turn on Muqtada Sadr and his movement. And in fact, they're already moving against Sadr in a variety of ways. I think they would like to split his movement by introducing a peer competitor to him, which they've begun to do, and also by exerting pressure against him as a leader so that they can contain him. They're also focused on thwarting federalism, which is a threat to the centralized state that they're building. Their aim is to ultimately consolidate full control over the Iraqi institutions. Now, what will this mean for Iraq, in my view? Well, I think they'll probably succeed, all things being equal and barring other wildcard events, in pushing Alawi himself and other major Iraqiyya politicians out of political life. And they'll probably succeed for the near term, in consolidating nominal control of the state. But as they do it, I think they will actually destabilize Iraq even further. I think the country will actually slip from their grasp, because they can seize control of the state, but they can't actually control, secure, and stabilize the country, because the Iraqi state can't secure and stabilize the country. It is not an effective state thus far. So thus, their scheme of consolidation, I believe, if it's followed to their logical conclusion, will probably greatly increase the risk that the country will be thrown back into civil war, especially when you consider that Iraq, as the risks of civil war grow, will be next door to a Syrian civil war, in which the competing political blocs in Iraq will be intervening in the Syrian civil war on opposing sides. And they're likely also to be intervening elsewhere in the region on opposing sides. First and foremost, Bahrain, who knows where else? Eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia, we can predict where this would, eventually Lebanon, we can predict where this would go. So anyway, I think in the near term then those are the trends that will dominate Iraqi politics. There's one underlying trend that I think increases the potential, though, that this state consolidation project could completely unravel. And let me say, this is a worst case scenario, I think, for the Iraqi political blocs. But let me describe it. I think there remains, while this elite political competition is going on, and while the consolidation of state institutions is going on, there is an Iraqi society that is growing more and more alienated from the state, which is not capable and does not appear to be willing of delivering the minimum that a state is meant to deliver to its citizens in terms of essential services, security, and so on. And so as the Malikiyun are congratulating themselves for seizing control of Iraqi state institutions, there is the potential over time that the Iraqi street could just explode against them. Now, what will the Malikiyun do in that regard? Well, we've already seen a taste of what they would do, because in 2011, Iraq had an Arab Spring, which not many people noticed and which didn't last too long. And the Malikiyun are the men who made the decision to deploy the Iraqi security forces and fire on crowds. So their answer to the grievances and requirements of Iraqi communities is not to try and make the state more effective or to increase participation or to make the common Iraqis feel heard. It's rather to use the coercive arms of the state to suppress dissent. And that's why I think that potentially it's possible you would have a train wreck that could undo the whole Iraqi state system. So, on that uplifting note, why don't we throw it open to questions from some of the very smart people in the audience? So we have microphones. Why don't we start small? Let's take the first two questions, and then we'll move on from there and take them maybe in groups of three. And remember to address your questions either to Marina or Ambassador Melker. And not to me. Right?
So, and please identify yourself.
Can we start? Let's start with Mr. Ericott, and then over here to Moises Naim.
Yes, my name is Saeed Ericott from Al Quds Daily newspaper. Marina, I don't see how you could really downplay the impact of the U.S. invasion on unleashing the demons of sectarianism, when in fact what they did, they just constructed the state. But my question is to Ambassador Ad Milker. On, you know, you said that the tensions have decreased in the north regarding disputed territories. How does that impact Article 140? What is its status? What is its fate? And to you, Colonel, will the Malikiyun cut a deal with Barzani for going Kirkuk for political purposes? Thank you.
Right. Okay. That was three questions. So why don't we go ahead and take Mr. Ericott's three questions, and then we'll come back for three more. Marina, do you want to start?
That was just a comment, and I frankly couldn't hear what you said. We can talk about it.
Well, on the disputed territories, which at some point seemed to be really this kind of powder keg that was waiting to explode, I believe that for the time being, the main forces do not have a real interest in trying to maximize polarization and confrontation. One could maybe even say that there has been some remarkable, I wouldn't call it reconciliation, but kind of rapprochement for various reasons between the Sunni sides, particularly in the northern province of Nineveh, and the Kurdistan region. I think the brothers Najafi, the Speaker of Parliament, and the Governor of Nineveh play a role there to try to find kind of balance of interest in how who could be in charge of which part of the disputed territories in the future. I also don't think that Maliki, I'm not agreeing with everything that that was said on Maliki's position, but definitely he is in the center of power, also in terms of defining the agenda. And I don't think that part of his agenda is to seek confrontation on Article 140 or the future of Kirkuk or whatever. There's just one issue that is a very serious one. And that is the ongoing problem between the federal government in Baghdad and the regional government in Erbil on the oil production and the oil proceeds. And some of the major oil companies are also squeezed now between the two sides in that fight. But I don't think it has the potential to blow up the institutional structure. So to cut to be very brief in the answer, it is not as prominent in terms of risk as it was, yet as long as the fundamental issues have not been resolved, it could of course always come up and be used for whatever purpose at some point.
and answer your question about the Malikiyun and Kirkuk. The Malikiyun will dangle Kirkuk in front of Masoud Barzani for as long as they need to keep him neutral as they consolidate their position against Alawi and against the Sadr movement. And then at such time as they are able, they will renege on whatever promise they held out to Masoud, and they will slowly not causing a violent confrontation, but they will slowly, creepingly improve their position in Kirkuk, and they will just and they'll just hold out the threat of force in order to ensure that the Kurds, the KRG, never gets Kirkuk. The Malikian will never let the KRG have Kirkuk. So let's start with Moises Naim, and then go over to David.
Oda Aberdeen. The three speakers ignored one issue. If you look at the history of Iraq.
I'm sorry, I called you Moises Naim. I'm very apologize.
From 1910, when Iraq was occupied by the Turks, the Iraqi officers in the Turkish corps were organizing secretly to fight for independence. From 1920 on, Iraqi politics was revolving around Iraqi nationalism. It continued in the 60s after the overthrow of the monarchy. It continued until, I would say, the invasion of Kuwait. And I think Iraqis are proud nationalists. Iraqi nationalism will resurface. So I think we need to pay more attention. We need to read Iraqi history and the role of Iraqi nationalism. In the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, the theme was Iraqi nationalist. You didn't hear people saying, I'm a Shiite. You didn't hear people say, I'm a Sunni. This thing, yes, under Saddam, he used overwhelming force against, you know, people in the south of Iraq, the war with Iran. But I believe if you look ahead, the Iraqis will go back to their nationalist tendencies and they will create a democratic secular state.
Okay.
It may take 10 years, 20 years, but...
You are taking more questions.
Yeah, why don't we, thank you for that comment. Why don't we go ahead and take two more questions over here? I'm going to refrain from calling, from guessing at anyone's name from this point.
Yeah, David Mack from the Middle East
Institute.
I'll
get it wrong, except for Ambassador Reese.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Melkert, for trying to point us to some optimistic potential, and we can all hope you're right. But I'm going to ask the more negative-minded strategists, Marina Ottaway and Colonel Rayburn, to focus on some worst-case scenarios in Iraq. And tell me what you think are the worst of them, and which ones, and what the implications are for U.S. policy. The first would be a failed state with some vast ungoverned spaces. The second would be a government dominated by Shia religious parties, but not by one man, and subject to overwhelming Iranian influence as they shift and form different coalitions. The third would be an authoritarian government ruthlessly guarding its internal power and trying to remain independent of external influences.
Okay, and right next to David here. Microphone is over here.
Yeah, from Wiese with the Jerusalem Report and Dutch Radio. Mr. Melkert mentioned the perception of the state of Iraq, and also briefly the oil interest. So I would like to ask more generally, what is the perception of the business community and specifically the oil companies about the future and the stability of Iraq? Are they ready to invest in long term in Iraqi oil, or are they still withholding because of the uncertainty?
Okay, and maybe one more. Who else? Here in front.
Art Donnert, CityOne.com, and the Catholic Messenger. Since many of the problems are sectarian, would it be a helpful approach to reconvene the World Parliament of Religion? And given the fact that sectarianism tore much of the Christian world apart for 500 years, but with the advances in communication, it's been within the last 50 years that many of these sectarian issues have been resolved. So would there be hope in that direction?
Oh, okay. Marina, do you want to start with
David's
worst-case scenarios?
Yeah. I just wanted to make a quick comment first with what Oda said. Nationalism was, First of all, once sectarian identities are out of the bag, it's very difficult to put them back in. I mean, we see around the world. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but usually it takes a long time before this division here. The other part of the answer is that usually sectarian, the sort of nationalism revives at a period of, at a time of external threat. And at this point, the whatever external threat might exist, is going in the direction of dividing the country. Iran is an external threat to the Sunni population, it's not to the Shia population. So I don't see at this point a revival of nationalism. Now, concerning the David Mack's question about the worst case scenario, that's a tough one. I would argue that from the point of view of the United States, and here I'm going to be cynical, probably the of the three alternatives that you gave us, in other words, you did not give us the rosy alternative of a nice democratic country, but of the three alternatives, probably the one that's least threatening to the United States is an authoritarian government that is in control. It's sad to say so, but in a sense, it's the one that we can live with more easily. Between the failed state and the government dominated by Shia close to Iran, probably the government dominated by Shia close to Iran is the worst, but it's a close call between those two, I would say.
Ambassador, do you want to cover the international oil companies?
Yeah, the business community and particularly the oil communities, I think they're very, very strongly present now and are anticipating also a new round and probably more rounds of auction of a number of still considerable fields for production in the south of Iraq. There's increasing exploration going on in Anbar, in the western part of the country, and definitely also lots of investment in the Kurdistan region. But certainly also in the south, there is a concern by quite a few companies about, say, the direct security of the infrastructure. And this is a mix of threats of a, say, more political nature, but also criminality that is on the rise in some parts of the country. But overall, the business community is not discouraged. On the contrary, I would say, and it's not only oil. Is also hugely in construction and also some other industries where foreign investors in particular are, in my view, quite close to take important decisions. Let me make one remark on the role of nationalism. I very much appreciated the question in reference to stages in Iraq's history that are very important for us to grasp in order to understand the things, the situation today and tomorrow. And I believe the role of nationalism is very important. I'm not sure whether that nationalism could then be made equal to a democratic way of dealing with that nationalism. But certainly it's helpful also to understand the position of Iraq vis-a-vis Iran, because the nationalist side, including, say, the non-ideological driven nature of the state consolidation project is a very important notion, and in that sense Iraq is very much a country in itself, a nation in itself, in as far as it concerns the Arab side, distinguishing itself even in religion, in terms of the religion, from the state theocracy in Iran. And I think it's also relevant to note that the scars of the Iran-Iraq war are still felt very much and mostly in the south. Mm-hmm. So we should not underestimate that element in the kind of easy perception, like here you have Iran, there you have the south of Iraq, and where is the border? There is really a border in many dimensions. Optimism, I hope I don't qualify by being slightly optimistic. So it's partly genetically, but part because otherwise you can't survive in the position that I had in Baghdad. But it's in fact also related to this question, will they adhere to the rules of the game? And once that wouldn't be the case, then also for me, the scenarios would come a lot closer to the kind of options that you were describing. But for the time being, I don't see the forces, including the Maliki forces, having an interest in turning around, actually, the or putting upside down the current situation. And finally, on the sectarian side, I mean, the most important is, of course, what is happening in the Islamist world. There is the OIC, the Conference of Islamic Countries, that is playing a role, but not a great impact, as far as I can tell. Thank you.
Okay. So let's take some more questions. The gentleman in the yellow tie right there, which is very fetching, by the way. And then we'll move. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Wright. I'm from the Department of State. But in a previous life, I served as a civil affairs officer in Iraq with the Marine Corps. And my question really goes to the ground level. Maria, you talked about pluralism as a reaction to authoritarian rule. I'm going to try to talk today. But too much of that can lead to little traction, can lead to many political parties, everybody wants their say. It certainly saw a lot of that. The question I have is what's it going to take to coalesce a group of people, modern Iraqis, many of which who have lived under heavy-handed rule, don't know much of a life without that heavy-handed rule, that authoritarian system. Many of them acquiesce to the point of simply just trying to stay alive. What's it going to take to get Iraqis to not allow for a return under the modern-day system, the modern politicians they have, to return to that central authoritarian rule, that heavy-handed society? What's it going to take on the ground for the people to not allow for that rule, especially when many of them don't know what that society looks like? So, thank you very much.
Okay, we had a couple in the back. Let's way back in the back, young lady with the glasses. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. Taking into account that there is no kind of conventional deterrence against terrorism in the region. If you have the possibility, just to Marina this question, if you have the possibility to lay out a kind of strategy against this kind of closed societies moved by a deep religious feeling, to which area of the society will you address that kind of layout in order to neutralize terrorism and recruitment in the region?
Okay, and let's take one more. We had the gentleman in the last row who just put your hand up and then write down. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weinchoff from the University of Wisconsin. Our speakers spoke about pluralism and the rise of sectarian politics, and also about multiple party politics. And I think an essential element for this kind of society is respect for minorities. And in that type of context, I'd like to ask what they see as the trends, particularly for the Christian minority in Iraq. We haven't heard much about that.
Okay. Ambassador, do you want to start with the what will it take for Iraqis not to return to the central heavy central rule model?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because what might seem for us kind of obvious as to how you want to see the ground principles of authority defined in your country is not at all that obvious for different generations of Iraqis. I would say that first and foremost, it's important that there will be a functioning state. And this has also a political connotation, going back to what Colonel said on the state consolidation project. I think that some serious investments are going on. For instance, I had different meetings with Deputy Prime Minister Sharistani, who is overseeing the rehabilitation of the electricity sector, which has been a huge problem and which was one of the reasons why people took the streets last year. Everybody complaining about it everywhere. And of course, I don't know what exactly today happens, but I would not be surprised, let me put it that way, that as was indicated, in the course of next year and the year after, because it really takes 2-3 years to have such huge infrastructure rehabilitation in place, that Iraqis would notice that the daily circumstances would improve. The same goes for investment domestically, internationally, and employment creation. And this is, of course, not only in Iraq a big issue. It is the issue of the region that there will be employment for the young people. And also in Iraq, the demography is showing a tremendous group of young people, ever better qualified, that are looking for a job. So those, and the third thing that's going on right now as we speak is a number of very important housing projects, including in Baghdad, that will, I think, improve the living circumstances, living conditions for quite many people. Not for all, unfortunately, because it's a bit selective, but it will have an impact. So to the extent, to the extent that these things would be put in place, it would relax in a way, and also would make Iraqis understand that elections serve a purpose. This is going to be the huge challenge in the preparation for the 2014 parliamentary elections, because definitely people will come back to their representatives and ask them, what did you do for me? So that is, I think, a basic notion.
Yeah, let me jump in there for just a moment, to complement what the ambassador has just covered. I think also Iraqis need a restoration of Iraqi civil society, which civil society utterly atomized under Saddam, with the exceptions of those layers of civil society that he could use in order to strengthen his rule. Also, the growth of a vibrant Iraqi private sector would also so we're talking about insulation between that model of a centralized state and the population. And there's no insulation right now, or very little. The Iraqi private sector is absolutely anemic. The public sector is huge. The private sector is essentially through because of crony capitalism and investment frameworks and legal frameworks that are in their infancy. The Iraqi private sector just is dwarfed by the public sector right now. Let me emphasize the point that the ambassador made about housing. Right now, the housing shortage in Iraq is a driver of conflict. The Iraqi government, according to Iraqi government statistics themselves, there is a shortfall of 3 million housing units in Iraq, and the Iraqi state right now has near sole responsibility for meeting that housing shortfall, and that state is not capable. The Iraqi ministries and the line ministry offices at provincial level are not capable of filling that 3 million shortfall in a country of 27 million. Marina, do you want to talk about the strategy?
Yeah, but I also want to talk about this for a moment, because it seems to me that they, you know, certainly these are good things and it would be very important to happen and then make life for Iraqi better. They would not necessarily prevent the consolidation of an authoritarian state. You can have, look at Saudi Arabia, it's doing all sorts of things for its citizens, and it's certainly not becoming, any more democratic than it was. I mean, the temptation, that what is tempting to answer is, look at the example of the so-called the Arab Spring, essentially the uprising in any countries, and what has led, it's people getting fed up with the situation. And we still don't understand what triggers it, because we can speculate as much as possible, but, none of us can give a coherent explanation of why it happened in 2011 rather than happening at some other time, let's face it. So that you say what would really prevent the consolidation of a new authoritarianism is people really taking things into their own hands. it does not necessarily work. I mean, the colonel talked about the repression when the first street protest started. They were put down pretty quickly, essentially. And we are seeing more and more in the Arab world, too, that governments, the uprisings, like the ones we saw in Tunisia and Egypt, that don't necessarily work once governments are aware that this can happen. Because if you think about it, the two governments that allowed themselves to be overthrown, if you want, were Tunisia and Egypt, that were caught by surprise. Assad did not allow himself to be caught by surprise, so that there is no guarantee that even that would work. Very briefly on the issue of terrorism, what we have I wish I had an answer. What we have seen in Iraq in the past, one thing that did happen to de-escalate the tensions was the negotiations that took place, the attempt to turn supporters of the creations of the awakening, the militias that sort of turn against local militias that turn against these groups and essentially sided with the government. Whether that can be repeated in the future, I don't know, but that is the only time, I think, where we saw an effort that worked fairly successfully for a period of time. At least I don't know what.
And Ambassador, can you cover the Christian minorities question?
Yes, I think that's a very important question, given what happened, particularly in the period, if I recall well, between October 2010 and last summer, when a number of very vicious attacks took place that targeted Christians for, I think, very different reasons and different agendas that were played out there. I don't think one should associate it with a kind of organized drive to reduce the presence of the small minority that the Christians represent in Iraq, but the impact was clear because many left in addition to the many that had left already in recent decades, basically. So the community is now quite small. Although the situation has slightly improved, particularly in Nineveh, measures have been taken to increase protection, including through their own representatives. The Kurdistan government at some point also opened some possibilities for Christians to stay there if they want it. I'm not exactly aware about the numbers that accepted that offer. So, recently, I don't think that we have seen much particular news on that, but the overall situation or the overall impact of what has happened is that the Christian community right now is very small indeed.
Right. A few more questions. In the very back row, the gentleman there. Okay. And then we'll come up to you next.
Hugh Grindstaff, THIS for Diplomats. The expatriate... The Iraqi expatriate community got us into the last war, the Shalabi. But you've had two sets of 2003 expatriates, and then the war sent a lot of people out of country. What influence on current Iraqi society do you think that the expatriates are having or not having, and why? Percentage or not, and why not?
Okay. And the young lady here in the fourth row.
Jay Newton-Small with Time Magazine. My question is about the State Department's recent decision to have its staff in Baghdad. Do you think it's still possible to carry out the stated U.S. mission there? And what involvement do you see the U.S. having in Iraq over the next few years? I guess it's hard to predict, but whatever you can predict.
Okay. And let's take one more. Okay, gentleman just behind her. Yeah.
Thank you. What role do you see for the UN moving forward with the decreasing U.S. presence, particularly in elections and in observing elections in the coming years? Thank you.
Very good. Okay. Question on the Iraqi expat community. Either of my co-panelists want to take that one on.
Let me try. There is the first, the pre-2003 generation, and I think they had, many of, they are very much in the political game at this point and had a big impact. I don't think we have seen a lot of important of people who have left in exile at the worst time of the violence and are coming back and playing a very important role. If that exists, I don't know. What I'd be really worried about now, but that's more of a question of almost like a humanitarian issue, what's going to happen to all the Iraqis that left and sought refuge in Syria with what is going on now? It's not so much what impact that they are going to have on Iraq, but where are they going to go? What's going to happen there?
And why don't we move to the role of the UN moving forward? Ambassador, do you want to cover that one?
Yeah, well, of course, I don't have any official authority right now in saying what should happen, but I've got some ideas. I think it's quite right in the question to emphasize the role in elections, although it will be a different one than before, as 2010 was already different compared to the previous elections, in the sense that the leadership, also in 2010, was really in the hands of the Independent High Electoral Commission, which is a broadly based Iraqi commission. And right now, the UN, UNAMI, the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq, is involved in assisting the Council of Representatives in selecting the members for the new Independent High Electoral Commission. And this is an extraordinarily important task in order to ensure that there will be sufficient political balance in that commission that will basically define the rules of the game within the rules of the game of the Constitution with regard to the election. And there is certainly some see some risk that an effort would be undertaken to have the composition of this independent commission influenced in such a way that it would become a political actor in itself. And that would really be a big risk to the constitutional process. Apart from this, the UN role remains, I think, very crucial to continue to monitor observation of human rights in different parts of the countries and really also in the broad sense of human rights, to report regularly, to work here very closely with the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Geneva. The third task is to assist the government in the framework of the so-called United Nations Development Assistance Framework, which is a $2 billion program assisting the government with technical advice in different areas of policy, trying to help to build the capacity of ministries, etc. There used to be a fourth area, but I'm not sure whether there's a lot of prospect right now to make progress, that is trying to assist in resolving the border issues still existing between Kuwait and Iraq going back to the Gulf War of 1991. I've been myself many times in Kuwait for that purpose, but unfortunately I cannot report an end result on that, and but it's still on the agenda of my successor.
Let me take a stab at the question about the U.S. Embassy and its staffing, but let me do so as an individual, not speaking for the Department of Defense or anyone else, just as an academic and offering my personal view. The U.S. diplomatic mission in Iraq, which was envisioned at being something on the order of 17,000 diplomats, staff, security contractors, and so on, and military personnel under chief of mission authority, was that was a mission that was planned for a different relationship than the one that exists between the United States and the Iraqi government now. And so conditions have dramatically changed from those that obtained when those plans were drawn up and when that relationship was outlined back in 2008, 2009, and 2010. The most significant thing is that there's no residual U.S. military force. And this has changed the nature of the relationship between the U.S. Government and the Iraqi political groups, so that the U.S. military is no longer there to act as, insofar as it could, as an honest broker in Iraqi politics, and as a deterrent from some of the actions that have been taken against U.S. personnel and agencies that are on the ground there. I would say that the relationship between the Iraqi government and its officials and the U.S. diplomatic mission is quite a bit more hostile than the one that was envisioned, which was one of very close partnership that would include a lot of capacity building activities on the U.S. side, a lot of ministerial assistance. And what we have found is that the nature, and I think it's also a byproduct of the state consolidation project that I described earlier, is that this assistance, this capacity building, is viewed in the context of the state consolidation project as interference and as an impediment to the consolidation of control of the state. And so it's not wanted, and so the Iraqi officials who respond to the Malikiyun and others then have been pushing U.S. presence, U.S. influence aside, or bringing pressure on U.S. influence. And at the same time, the threat environment for U.S. officials, U.S. security contractors, and to some extent, U.S. citizens who are there for business purposes, that the threat environment has grown more intense since, say, a year ago, and certainly by the end of the year, so that in particular, you have the threat from the Shia Islamist militias that are sponsored by the Iranian regime, an explicit threat against U.S. personnel. And this has greatly reduced the mobility of U.S. officials inside Iraq, so they can no longer get out of the embassy compound. They can no longer do the kind of engagement with Iraqi officials and Iraqi citizens that they need in order to do their job. And so after a while, you wind up just having several thousand people on an Indian reservation who don't really serve the strategic purpose anymore. And that caused conditions to change. At the same time, as the U.S., I think my personal view here, let me stress, the idea that you would withdraw the U.S. military to some extent because it was seen as an irritant in Iraq, and then replace the face of the U.S. military with security contractors working for the U.S. government in Iraq, I think was always problematic, because over time, I saw the U.S. military come to be accepted at the local level in many places as an honest broker, as a guarantor against local conflicts, and so on, while U.S. security contractors were universally vilified, especially after their behavior early on, and then incidents like the 2007 Blackwater killing of 17 Iraqis in West Baghdad. That poisoned Iraqis against U.S. security contractors. And so that was always going to be a difficult thing to keep going with a large U.S. diplomatic mission in that environment. Okay, our contract with you is to end at 2 o'clock, so I think we have time for perhaps one more question, if we have anyone who wants to ask a question. Let's have the lady over here to my left.
Good afternoon. Susan Arnold, United States Army. I'm a student at ICAF. And I'd like the panel members' views on, as Colonel Rayburn just indicated, our basic failure to come to an agreement with the Iraqis for any follow-on U.S. forces there in Iraq and the subsequent withdrawal. Do the panel members see that as ultimately a positive development, an inevitable development, or as a liability for U.S. strategic interests going forward? Thank you.
Ambassador, you want to take that one on first? You were there for some of that negotiation.
Yes, I witnessed it from quite close, and I didn't have, say, an opinion other than that it should be a bilateral agreement, as was the status of forces agreement that was in place until the end of last year. However, I had quite strong feelings from the very beginning that there was a kind of inevitability, that it would be very difficult to agree on the configuration, so maybe even not on the principle, and certainly that principle wouldn't be addressed by all actors as such. There were, of course, some forces that didn't want to have the U.S. forces in the first place, and others not for the future. But there were also quite many that didn't express themselves in those terms, but provided objections to actually any option that one could think of keeping some U.S. forces remaining in Iraq. And as you know, very many options were being discussed at some point in time. And the inevitability, in my view, goes back to the history, to the that's why the question on the national and the nationalist side of history is important, of the sovereignty idea that is very strongly represented, I think, across the board. So also those that feel actually quite close in terms of their own interest in working with the US still had a difficulty to envisage that they would make themselves or make their country dependent upon the presence of US forces, also in the context of the wider region that we shouldn't underestimate as well, because everybody has a lot of interaction with brothers in the region. So this sovereignty idea, I think it's very important to understand it. It's not a rejection necessarily of having U.S. forces in this case on the ground, but to be in charge. Even as UN, we have really noticed a change in attitude, and I don't say that in any critical way, because it's the full right of a sovereign state to define its own interaction with, in the end, a representation of a foreign institution. We have seen over time really a shift in terms of how the interaction was guided, and the word sovereignty came up in, so to speak, every second sentence.
Marina, do you have anything to add?
Essentially, there's just one point that I would like to add. I think it was anybody who was following the situation closely essentially saw it coming. What it did not come as a surprise. What it's very difficult for me to understand is why the U.S. government, until the last minute, presented this very positive the optimistic idea that the Iraqis wanted us to be there, that it would be a matter of time before some sort of arrangement, that the strategic framework agreement would remain very, very, very important, and so on. And frankly, my question, and I don't have an answer, remains whether, was the U.S. government just trying to spin the story because it was not a good idea to tell the public we are getting out, but this is going to be a much more drastic getting out, or did they end up by spinning themselves as well as spinning the public? I mean, I participated in some briefings for, think tank people shortly before the withdrawal took place, where the message was, there is no problem here. We are going to stay. These agreements are in the process of being worked out, and so on. So I'm left with a lot of questions.
Let me just add again a personal view, not speaking for any part of the U.S. government. I think that in retrospect, a mistake that we made was well ahead of 2011. We did not adequately send the message to Iraqis that a residual U.S. military force would be nested within a broader U.S.-Iraq relationship, and that it would just be one aspect of that relationship, and that because of that relationship and a partnership, that Iraqis would be getting quite a bit from the U.S. government. They would be the benefits of a partnership with the U.S. government would outweigh the negatives that that would come from the perceived infringement on Iraqi sovereignty that the ambassador is talking about. So we never, I think, did the work that we could have done to create top cover for Iraqi politicians who, behind closed doors, always up to the last minute, indicated that they thought it was in Iraq's interest for us to have a residual force there. We never did the work to give them selling points for that relationship with the United States. And we never, I think, adequately countered the message that was coming out of the Iranian-sponsored militant movements, including the Sadr movements, about violations of Iraqi sovereignty. We didn't push back enough on that messaging to make it clear to Iraqis how they would benefit from it. So I hope we learn that for future such negotiations, such as the one that will eventually be going on somewhat to the east of Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, maybe on that note, I think we're out of time, but if you'd please join me in thanking our two primary panelists here for a great discussion.